Hi, and welcome to Humanities Viewpoints, a podcast from the Humanities Institute at Wake Forest University. I'm your host, Program Coordinator Amy Meppam. Last week it was released that work will soon begin on a church planned to honor the deaths of a group of Egyptian Coptic Christians who were killed earlier this year by a Libyan militant group affiliated with the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. This is just one instance of violence against Coptic Christians in the Middle East, part of a complex history of persecution that goes back hundreds of years and continues today. On this episode of Humanities Viewpoints, Dr. Nellie Van Dorn Harder talks with me about the history of the Coptic Orthodox Church of Egypt, sectarian violence, and the current state of the church. Nellie Van Dorn Harder is professor of Islamic studies in the Department for the Study of Religions at Wake Forest University. Her research straddles issues concerning women and religion, human rights in Muslim countries, and the interreligious encounter between Muslims and Christians. She was born and raised in the Netherlands, where she earned her PhD on the topic of women in the Coptic Orthodox Church of Egypt at the Free University of Amsterdam. Her main books on Egypt are on Coptic nuns and the modern history of the Coptic popes. Before moving to the United States, she was director of a refugee program in Cairo, Egypt, and taught Islamic studies at universities in the Netherlands and Indonesia. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Thank you so much for being here today. So I was wondering if you could start us off by talking about a little bit about the foundation of the Egyptian Christian Church and Coptic Christians in Egypt, where and when it was established, and possibly, too, if we could get into this, a bit of the etymology of the word Copt and how that comes to mean or to refer to Christians in Egypt.
Sure. Well, thank you for inviting me. It is always wonderful to discuss the Coptic Orthodox Church of Egypt, because it is one of the oldest churches in the world. Basically, with the churches in the Middle East, maybe you remember in the New Testament, it says that the apostles go out. And according to the tradition, Peter, apart from being the primate in Rome, also founded the church in what is today Syria, Antioch. Antiochia, we call that, Antioch. And then another apostle, Mark, went to Egypt. And according to the tradition, he arrived there around the year, anywhere between 42 and 48 of the Common Era, and then was the first patriarch. And since then, the patriarchs of the Coptic Orthodox Church have been ruling in an unbroken line. And the current patriarch, called Tawadrus II, he is the 118th patriarch since St. Mark.
Right.
And Copts believe that the message about Christ was easily accepted in Egypt for several reasons. First of all, the pharaonic religion believed in hereafter. There had been pharaohs who had believed in a one divine being. Secondly, the Holy Family had taken refuge in Egypt, and they believed that the event was somehow lingering in the public memory. And nowadays, if you go to Egypt and you can follow the itinerary, which is based on a dream a medieval patriarch had of the Virgin Mary, who told them exactly where they had stopped. And so you can go all the way to the south of Egypt, almost near Luxor, a little bit more north of Luxor, and then come back to the delta of Egypt, and then they crossed over through Sinai, right? And you can, every part of the way, there is nowadays a monastery or a small church or at least some sign, like there's a footprint of baby Jesus here.
Really?
So
yeah.
this is something, you know, it is the whole geography of Egypt, the history, the myth, are all related in this respect. And then the third element that people felt, you know, St. Mark wasn't immediately beheaded or thrown into the sea, was that there was a large Jewish community living in Alexandria. And they also believed in the one God, and they believed in the Old Testament. You know, they had the Old Testament. So the faith somehow already was kind of building on earlier foundations that were there. And so the word Copt actually is very simple. It comes from Qipt, and Qipt was the way that the later on the Arabs indicated the original population of Egypt. Qipt meant Egyptian. And that comes from Aegyptos, from the Greek word, and basically later on it became to mean Copt, as in the Christian population of Egypt. But originally it was all the indigenous inhabitants of Egypt. After that, the history developed until the Arab invasion in the 7th century. Mm-hmm. The Coptic church really grew very rapidly. And what is very interesting, if you look at Egypt, is that Egypt has only basically had one ethnicity. Mm-hmm. Because Egypt is very... It's bordered off. In the north, you have the ocean or the sea, the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. Actually, the west and the east, you have mountain ranges. Mm-hmm. And then in the south begins a desert, and you go into Sudan. And so then you have the Nile, and around the Nile is where the land of Egypt basically developed, because that is where you could, you know, where it was fertile, where you could live. Yeah. And then the Nile splits, and that then creates the delta, which is the north of Egypt. Awesome. And so that is what is so unique in Egypt, mm-hmm. that unlike what we see now in Iraq, where different ethnic groups are fighting with each other. Mm-hmm. In Egypt, everybody considers themselves descendants of the pharaohs. Mm-hmm. What that exactly means, nobody knows, but they are descendants of the pharaohs, which means everybody traces their history to thousands of years back. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes the Coptic church also very unique, because it's always been, you know, the local church, mm-hmm. the church of Egyptians and of Egypt.
So how long is Christianity basically the religious majority in Egypt, and when does that start to change?
The first 300 years, there were on and off persecutions. Mm-hmm. Actually, the last very large persecution, very profound persecution, started in the year 284.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And that was Diocletian, mm-hmm. the Emperor Diocletian, who persecuted the Christian population to such an extent that the Copts actually start their calendar mm-hmm. in the year 284. That is called the Year of the Martyrs. But then, by the 4th century, Christianity became the religion of the Roman Empire, because Egypt actually always, since Christianity began in Egypt, Egypt was always occupied. It was always part of the Roman Empire or Greco-Roman Empire, and later it was occupied by the Muslims. And so Copts never had their own government. They never had their own coins. They never had their own parliament. They were always occupied people. And so by the 4th century, when the persecution stopped, Christianity really could take hold of the entire country. So by the time of the Arab invasion, the majority of Egyptians were Christians. So it has been quite a steady influence and presence since the 4th century, but already in the 1st, 2nd century was a very strong presence, because, first of all, the church in Alexandria was far more advanced than the church in Rome. For example, in Alexandria you had the theological school, where, you know, we all know the names of Origen, Clemens of Alexandria. Those were all teaching in that school. That mm-hmm. was the seminary for the Christian church at that time. And then we also see the beginning of monastic life. That started in Egypt. Mm-hmm. Saint Anthony, who went into the desert, and there's nowadays, that is in the eastern desert, there's a big monastery still called mm-hmm. the Monastery of Saint Anthony, and he felt he had to leave everything behind, because according to the tradition, Saint Anthony was from a wealthy family. And one day he realized that he should give up everything and follow that word of Christ, although he wasn't quite sure what it was, because, you know, the Bible was still being translated, you know, being codified. Most people in Egypt didn't really read and mm-hmm. write yet, so he went and wanted to find God in the desert. Mm-hmm. And then later on, you get what they call the Cenobitic form of monasticism, which means people living together. Pachom. He was the one who started that. And he also had a convent for his sister. So that's also when women started to become monks and nuns. So by the 3rd century, 3rd, 4th century, the place is just teeming with monks and nuns. It's just that it became almost a fashion to go into the monastery and do, you know, and these monasteries became really centers of social development, natural development. Mm-hmm. They would plant gardens. gardens. They would feed the population living in the villages around them. They develop art. They develop, you know, the Christian art. They writing styles. They would copy the Bible and all these, you know, and of course the teachings from the School of Alexandria. So it was quite a thriving community and a very sophisticated community at the time of the Arab invasion. But there was one problem. That is, in the early Christian years, we have two moments where Christianity split. And that is something that we have to understand, because that's why the Coptic Church somehow became an Egyptian church and not a universal church, or let's say linked up with Rome, and together they were, you know, with the early churches, they all became universal. And that was because at one point people started to think deeply about who was Jesus Christ? What was he? Was he human? Was he divine? Was he half-half? And so there was this priest called Arius, who started to preach in the 4th century that Jesus was just a regular Joe, a regular human being. And then the rulers or the church leaders thought, but what does that mean? That means that he's not divine, and that's the end of Christianity. Because the whole idea is that we believe that Jesus is the divine Son of God. Right. What that then exactly means, we don't know. We didn't know either. So they had all these councils. The first one in 321 was the Council of Nicaea.
That's where the creed comes from, right? The creed was
actually formulated by Athanasius the Great, who was one of the bishops and later on a patriarch of the Coptic Orthodox Church. And so in that time, they didn't call themselves Coptic Orthodox, they were just Christian, with everybody else, and everybody was struggling and growing. And then that problem kept simmering, and others came up and, you know, said Jesus was fully divine or he was fully human. And then in 451, they had Chalcedon. In Chalcedon, they had another council, and there they basically created what is now the creed of the Catholic Church. In lay terms, saying it's half-half. Jesus was half-half. And the Copts said, no, that you cannot say Jesus was half human and half divine, because these two natures were mingled together. And because they said, okay, if Jesus was half human and half divine, when he spoke in the Gospels, which part was speaking?
Right.
So they would just come up with all these, you know, all these possible questions that they could think of, like, how are we as people in our nature? You cannot split our natures, you know. Yeah. It's just we are like an ocean, and one drop in that ocean is part of the ocean, and on and on it went. But the problem was that the emperor accepted the Catholic creed, and the emperor called the shots. The emperor, it was still the ruler of Egypt. And so what happened then was that Rome became the prime church in the empire, and Alexandria, which was, let's say, the see of the Coptic popes, diminished in importance. And over time, the emperor even tried to enforce the Roman views on the Copts. And so basically, in the end, the churches split. And in the end, the Copts became persecuted by other Christians who were sent to, you know, enforce the Roman view of the creed. And of course, in the end, it was all about money and about politics. You know, what sounds so highly and lofty theological, it was really all about who has the power. Because when you had the power, you had the income, you were in charge of the economy, and Egypt was the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. Egypt was very, you know, everything around the Nile is extremely fertile, and so all the grain would be shipped to Rome. And so in those years, you get this real Coptic, you know, sense of identity. Like, we are Copts, we're Egyptian. We want to eat our own grain. Why is it being shipped to Rome all the time? But this is what the Muslims encountered when they then, in the 7th century, moved into Egypt.
Yeah, so I'm interested in how life then changes for Copts under Muslim rule.
Well, originally it was a relief, because there come Muslims and they believed in Saint Mary and they believed in Jesus and they believed in lots of prophets from the Old Testament, Moses, Abraham, Jonah. They had all these prophets. So many Christians in the beginning thought that they were another sect of Christianity. You know, by that time, the Middle East was teeming with sects because all these fights about the divinity of Christ. And the Muslims had the approach, they had a very interesting colonizing approach, that is like, we will rule you, but you can you have the freedom to practice your own belief as long as you believe in one and only God. And those people are what they are called the protected people, the dhimmis, where, you know, they can practice their own religion, but there are certain rules. They cannot be the rulers. And that is, of course, the hallmark of colonialism. And so when the Muslims came in, first of all, the persecution from other Roman, Greco-Roman Christians stopped. And so that was a great relief. Because actually, as the Muslims came in, the patriarch at that time was in hiding. And some patriarchs had been hiding their whole time that they were ruling. I wonder if anybody really saw them in the flesh. Because the moment that they would show themselves, you know, the imperial powers would move into them. And so in the beginning, the Muslims allowed the Christians to restore monasteries that had been destroyed, churches. They allowed the patriarch to come back to Alexandria and there settle and set up a church system again. And so it was a relief. And, you know, of course, the Muslims were a handful. They were a tiny minority. So they also were walking a very fine line in how to rule this community. But the luck, what really went into their advantage was that all these areas, basically most of the Middle East, was used to being colonized either by Greco-Roman Empire or by the what they now call Persian Empire. And only over time people started to convert. It was intermarriage, or people wanted to join the government, wanted to have a government job, and then they had to convert to Islam to have hold certain positions. Because the whole idea was that non-Muslims were lower in rank. So if you had to climb up in society, you might have to convert. And a lot of people didn't have that much trouble with it. Until at one point, the Christian leaders started to realize, no, this is a different religion. This is not just another sect of Christianity. This is entirely different. And so, but over time, you know, as this basically natural waves of conversion continued, it still took several hundreds of years for the Christian community to become the minority. That was not before the Middle Ages, by the 10th, 11th century. And what happened in between was that you had these moments where you had dynasties, because Egypt was ruled by lots of Muslim dynasties, that wanted to assert Islam. And often that even didn't have anything to do with Christianity. That was another interesting part. Often it was a fight between Shiites and Sunnites. Right. And in the meantime, the Christians were just kind of pushed into the background or were in the way and were crushed. Or if someone wanted to build a mosque in a place where a Christian chapel happened to be standing, the chapel had to go. And so it was these moments that Muslims want to assert themselves that Christians suffered. And sometimes this led to persecution. But a lot of the, like I said, a lot of the conversion was really through natural lines. And only by the 10th, 11th century, we know the patriarch started to write the sermons in Arabic. And that means that the Coptic language was no longer the language of the land, because when the Arabs came in, they spoke Arabic. Again, they were used to that. A Roman language, a Greek language, had been, especially Greek, had been the imperial language. And so people, you know, bureaucrats had to know that, had to learn that, and the Copts spoke Coptic. But then what you get when the tide turns, you get a lot of suppression that is not necessarily from the Muslims. For example, the Crusades. Suddenly we have the Crusades, which make the Christians in a place like Egypt double suspect. The Crusaders felt that they were heretical. They were not Catholics, related to Rome. And the Muslims were very suspicious because they thought these Copts are going to link up with these Crusaders. Mm-hmm. So the Copts were just in a double bind and basically, for that matter, Christians all over the Middle East. Mm-hmm. So that was one wave of suppression that led to, unintended persecution of the of the Christians mm-hmm. by Muslims in their own land. And so this has been ongoing. For example, if you then fast forward to the 19th century, when we get colonial powers moving into a place like Egypt, the British in the end of the 19th century, but before that, we have the coming in of British schools, French schools, actually by invitation of the Pasha, Muhammad Ali at that point, but by invitation they came in, but then they stayed and they started to change the mindset of people. And Christians were very attracted to this new education. So yeah. they went to these foreign schools and learned foreign languages. And suddenly Christians could hold jobs, you know, professional jobs like medical doctors, journalists, bankers, that Muslims couldn't hold yet because they didn't have the training. And so you get also this very strange division in society that suddenly Christians rose to power, and at the same time they were very much again suspected because, you know, are they linking up with these intruders, with these colonizers? But how, you know, having said that, the Copts themselves, you know, they were very much against Protestants, and they didn't want to, they absolutely did not want to link up with the Catholics. But at the same time, some Coptic Orthodox, because that is when you start to realize there's Orthodox Copts. The Orthodox right. faith is considered the original faith. And at that point, you have that some Copts become Protestant, also often for jobs or marriage, or because they were more attracted to the idea that you could read the Bible yourself in your yeah. own language. Mm-hmm. Other Copts became Catholic, and that could also be, for example, intermarriage with Syrian Christians or Armenian Christians right. who mm-hmm. were Catholic. Mm-hmm. Or because they had been in Europe and they were attracted to what they had seen there. And so what you get in the 19th century, you get a small Protestant church that calls itself the Coptic Protestant Church, mm-hmm. and you get a Catholic church that calls itself the Coptic Catholic Church. So you get this very strange emancipation going on during the 19th century, and part of the emancipation was that the original status under Muslim law for non-Muslims, this protected people status, also called the dhimmi status, disappeared, was abolished. Because they realized, you know, with all the trade going on between Europe and other places, it just didn't hold anymore. Mm-hmm. It was very strange. And so Copts were emancipated, mm-hmm. became fully Egyptian, became equal citizens. Mm-hmm. And from then on, you get a real Coptic nationalism and a really, you know, striving to be, you know, inhabitants of Egypt and serving Egypt.
Could you talk a little bit about the coup in 1952 sure. and how that sure. Changes and adds to the sort of marginalization of the Copts?
Well, if we think about, you know, the revolution, the Nasser revolution of 1952, mm-hmm. we have to actually go back to the year 1948 first, because already during the revolution there were all kinds of problems for the Copts, and of course with the foundation of the State of Israel. At that time, the Muslim Brotherhood really stirred up the debate: are these Copts loyal to Egypt or not? Do they are they pro-Palestine or pro-Israel? Not realizing that later on the Coptic Church would take a stance to be pro-both, and they till today, Copts actually are not allowed to take the pilgrimage to Jerusalem mm-hmm. or to Israel mm-hmm. because the Coptic Church still demands that the state of Palestine is being acknowledged mm-hmm. as a full mm-hmm. and independent state. Mm-hmm. And so, but at that time, you know, nobody had made up their mind about anything. Mm-hmm. And so when 1952 came around, there was already quite a pressure on the Copts. And at that time, the economic policies of Nasser, they really took away 75% or more of Coptic wealth, because he basically nationalized all the property, like factories, land, farmland, and then redistributed it. And Copts had a lot of farmland. They owned a lot of the large farms or the large holdings, especially in the south of Egypt. And so they lost a lot of their income, which meant that the monasteries, for example, also lost income, churches lost income, the buildings could no longer be repaired, and people felt that they lost their jobs. And that is the time when Copts started to immigrate. They often, they didn't say, I'm going to go and live in the West. Often they went to the West to study. Okay. They went for an MA, you know, graduate studies, mm-hmm. or stayed for a PhD, mm-hmm. and then decided to stay. Mm-hmm. And so you see that development it come to fruition in the 60s mm-hmm. when the first Coptic churches start to be founded. The very first one was in Canada in the 1960s. Right. And then over time, you know, as there are recurring episodes, mm-hmm. and it's not so much persecution, although being a Copt is, you know, you always have to look over your shoulder. Maybe they're going to attack my shop, or maybe they're going to attack my church. But it often comes back to local grievances, mm-hmm. like between two villages that are fighting with each other, and then the Copts are, you know, are wonderful scapegoat to blame and to attack. Or there's a grievance about some business deal where two people get into a quarrel, and then on each side are others join them, and before you know it, you get a big fight. Mm-hmm. But also, it's as the general economic condition of Egypt went up and down, mm-hmm. Copts would leave. It's not just the Copts; also other Egyptians would leave. You know, in bad economic times, they would leave. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, what is extremely interesting is that in the same period of time, in the 50s and 60s, the Coptic church, there was suffering, and there was a lot of infighting, and they had a lot of, you know, a lot of people really predicted the Coptic church is going to just stop existing. Mm-hmm. By the 21st century, we won't have a Coptic church. It revived. Mm-hmm. There was a renaissance. A renaissance started to somehow, you know, develop within the church. And one of the people who was spearheading it was a patriarch called Cyril the Sixth, and he only ruled from 59 to 71, but he was an extremely brilliant ruler. What he saw all the discontent young Copts who just said, all these priests, you know, they're just mumbling about and they're not educated, and he saw young Copts with good educations. And he saw what women did. Women started to go to school and became medical doctors and became, you know, teachers. And he took all the discontent and all the potential and all the talent and bound it together and invited these people to join the church and gave them space. Mm-hmm. So he allowed these young people to do things that in the hierarchy, you know, of the church they never had been able to do. Right. And he energized an entire new generation. And so, you know, it was the beginning of a reaffirmation of Coptic identity, of mm-hmm. Coptic legacy, history, mm-hmm. and a rediscovering of the tradition and the heritage.
Can we move, you know, into sure. sort of present day and talk about what some of the current threats aimed at Copts are today, particularly from extremist mm-hmm. groups like ISIS?
Well, the threat is that there's certain radical-minded Muslims mm-hmm. who feel that the Copts, A, should not be in Egypt. They should have converted to Islam mm-hmm. long ago. Right. These are stubborn, ignorant people who did not see the truth of Islam. That's how they are being considered. Mm-hmm. And they feel that they should, you know, retrieve the position of dhimmi, mm-hmm. of the protected mm-hmm. minority, okay. who cannot study certain things, who cannot have certain positions. So If you apply the official Islamic law in all sections of society, then you will apply that type of citizenship, a secondary citizenship, and that is a huge issue. Mm-hmm. That is a huge issue. That's why ISIS basically kills mm-hmm. or drives out all the Christians, because they do not have to face that issue. Mm-hmm. You know, because in the 21st century, you cannot make an official secondary rated group of people. Mm-hmm. You cannot create that. That mm-hmm. is impossible in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. And that's what they want. Mm-hmm. And the problem was when, at one point, the Muslim Brotherhood became powerful, only for a few years, but when they won the elections and Morsi became the president, they started to act on that mindset. They did not officially apply it, but they acted on it, and it became okay to attack these extremely stubborn people who did not convert to Islam and should actually have a lower position. And so that it was really, all of a sudden it was as if the floodgates were opened. And so there was this underlying idea that these people shouldn't be here, these people should know their place. And so then you have this very strange situation mm-hmm. because, you know, there's a lot of Copts who are multimillionaires. So some mm-hmm. of the richest Egyptians are Copts. Mm-hmm. They oversee, you know, these huge conglomerates right. that mostly employ Muslims. Mm-hmm. And so how can you even come up with an idea like that, and it doesn't work. And that's basically why that part of the revolution failed, because then the attacks on the Copts became so onerous that, you know, the whole world started to take notice. And that ended up in August of last year, when in one weekend, first after a second coup, the new government suppressed the Muslim Brotherhood, and then in a backlash all over Egypt, Copts were attacked, and over 100 Coptic houses of worship, schools, libraries were being destroyed or, you know, erased, basically. Right. There were churches that had survived from the 8th, 9th century that were destroyed. In a way, it's the same old, same old. There is, when you keep an eye on the news in Egypt, there's always an attack somewhere, sometime. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the Coptic Church says, we are part of this land, we are part of the population. Our goal is to help build Egypt. That's it. And so that is, you know, and we don't look back. We don't look back. This is gone, this is past. We're going to rebuild what was destroyed, and we hope that something else will come out of it. Yeah. And so that is, you know, that it has created a very interesting attitude about Muslim-Christian relations, which is, in a way, insisting on the fact we are brothers, we are from the same soil, and whatever happens, we have to get along. That is the bottom line. It very much influences my teachings that I know this history, because it has put in perspective for me how exactly this whole spreading of Islam went. You know, you hear spreading with by weapons, by armies, but most of it was demographic, as I say, very natural, and how communities can live together. Right. But at the same time, how you know. This mindset has developed in certain groups of Muslims that Christians and Jews and other who are not Muslim should be, you know, of the dhimmi or the secondary status. So in a way, it has really given me quite a perspective of how communities live together, how they develop together, and how strife comes into existence in communities. And I share a lot of that during my classes. So that is how it influences my teachings on Islam a lot. Because, you know, you can basically, you can tell the story from both sides.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to this episode of Humanities Viewpoints. You can find other episodes on the Humanities Institute website, humanitiesinstitute.wfu.edu, as well as on iTunes.